For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a wide-ranging, fun conversation about how math can help us understand ourselves and the world in which we live. In part two, the author of the book Sizing Up the Universe will try to explain just how immense the universe is and how small we are within it. Here's part one of today's program. If you love the world of mathematics, and even if you don't, I think you nonetheless need to explore a book which really helps us understand how mathematics can be an amazing tool to help us understand the world around us, and can help us understand a lot of what happens to us in our lives, right down to why things never work out quite like we want at the car garage, why schedules don't play out exactly the way we want to, why predictions sometimes fall so far from reality, why it sometimes seems like the worst possible thing occurs. All kinds of interesting things about our daily lives tied to mathematics in a new book called How Math Explains the World. A Guide to the Power of Numbers from Car Repair to Modern Physics. The author is James D. Stein, Professor of Mathematics at California State University in Long Beach. And the book is published by Collins. It's a Smithsonian book. And I am really happy to have this opportunity to speak with the author. Professor James D. Stein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Thanks for inviting me.
I am really looking forward to this very much, although I have to say I come to this as someone who is not particularly adept at mathematics and very, very rusty. I have to say right off the bat that I found your book unexpectedly accessible, and I think you talk in the preface of the introduction about how you really took great pains to try to put together a book which anybody could read, even people that are not math majors who have not had math in a long time.
Well, I tried to do my best. Because it's a book about math, you almost have to put some equations in. But I tried to write it in such a way that if you aren't comfortable with the actual details of it, what you could always do is you could always, when you see equations being presented, you can just skip to where the text continues, because mathematicians love to put in equations, because for us they not only represent great truths, as Einstein's E equals mc squared does, but they're also the connecting links between truths.
I love the quotation you have of the famous writer and I think physicist Stephen Hawking for his book A Brief History of Time, and you draw a really interesting parallel or sort of take his quotation sort of to its furthest application in terms of your own book. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Surely. Stephen Hawking, in the preface to A Brief History of Time, said that his publishers told him that for every equation that he put in the book, the readership would dwindle by 50%. And so he said, I can't write a book on physics without putting in E equals mc squared. So he put a book in, he put E equals mc squared in, and the book was a New York Times bestseller. And I have to feel that people who pick up a math book, and with the word math in the title, they've decided to read it, are willing to put up with some equations. And if every time I put in an equation, it reduced the readership by 50%, there are 6 billion people roughly in the world, and by the time you get to the 33rd equation, only one person is left to read the book.
So you really hope they're wrong
in
their prediction.
Not only do I hope they're wrong, my publishers certainly hope they're wrong, too.
Right. Also in that preface is a really delightful little story you tell about your own father. And a day when you wanted to toss a football around with him, but he had something important to do first.
Yes, my father was a very meticulous businessman, and every month what he would do is he would take all his expenses and all his incomes and put them on a big yellow sheet of paper. I can still remember this. And it sort of looked like an Excel spreadsheet does now. And I remember on a particular fall afternoon, fall being football season, I wanted to toss the football around. And my father said, I got to get this sheet to balance, but it shouldn't take long because there is an error of 36 cents. And whenever you see an error that's divisible by 9, it probably happened because you switched some numbers around. And he explained to me that if he had meant to write down 48, but he actually wrote down 84, switching the 8 and 4, then 84 minus 48 was 36, which is divisible by 9. And so since I wasn't going out for a while, I decided to get a pad and try it. And I got 72 and switched them and got 27 and subtracted, and the difference was 45, which was divisible by 9. Even though I was only 8 years old at the time, I knew my division by 9 and my multiplication table. And I tried it for a while, and it fascinated me that it was true. But of course, being only 7 or 8 years old, I couldn't see how I would manage to establish this for all possible collections of numbers unless I actually worked through all of them. But it turns out that later on that I discovered that algebra has a shortcut for doing this. But anyway, this was my first insight into the fact that there was more to arithmetic than simply adding up things and learning the multiplication table.
Right. Well, and it was probably, in a sense, one of your first experiences of how mathematics engaged with the real world, apart from the sort of obvious story problems that we might remember from elementary school. I mean, this is another, in a sense, more vivid example of how math is really relevant to our daily lives.
I certainly think, and I think every mathematician and every math teacher feels the same way, that we're teaching one of the most relevant subjects you could possibly imagine. And the example that I use in the book to illustrate some of the difficulties that we encounter in trying to use mathematics is how difficult it is to schedule car repairs at a garage, which explains why when they told you it would be ready at 4 o'clock and you call at 3:45 and say, can I come over and pick up my car, you find that the car isn't ready. When you look at a relatively simple job, like you have to pay the monthly bills, so you have a stack of bills, you get the checkbook, you write a check, you put it in an envelope. After you've done a few of these, you see the stack of bills dwindling, and after a while, you can see that you're getting closer and closer to the end. But with the car repair problem, if a garage has a bunch of cars in the shop and they start making out a schedule for it, they get to the end and they may find that they've got 4 cars, all of which need the hydraulic lift at the same time, so they have to tear up the schedule and start again. And even when they manage to complete a schedule, they might look at the schedule and say, well, I wonder if we changed the spark plugs on the Chevy earlier, whether we could have finished a little sooner. Even when you complete the job, you can't be sure that you've done the best job possible. And that's an indication of why this is such a difficult problem. And it's so difficult a problem that there's a $1 million prize out if you can solve it.
In other words, if there is a relatively simple, tidy solution for that, it would be huge. But you suggest at the end of the chapter, some problems may well be so complex that there is no perfect way to solve them.
Yeah, we've encountered this as a phenomenon from the 20th century. One of the things that we have difficulty with is we have difficulty with lots of tasks that involve prediction. Of course, what we would love to be able to do is predict the weather. You'd love to be able to predict predict the weather 3 to 5 days in advance so you know whether or not you can plan a picnic. But you'd also like to know whether or not the weather that we see and the weather that we saw in the past really is indicative of a phenomenon like global warming, because, of course, you know that's a highly controversial topic. And it turns out that the equations that govern weather are so delicate that there's no really adequate way that we can do a good job of predicting the weather. You've probably heard the term the butterfly effect, which was coined by one of the first people to investigate this topic. And it's a beautiful phrase because it illustrates the idea that the equations that govern weather are so sensitive to initial differences that whether or not a butterfly flaps its wings in Hawaii could determine whether or not there's a tornado 3 weeks later in Oklahoma.
One of the funniest quotes in the book is from somebody named Niels Bohr. I don't know that name, but he observed prediction is difficult, especially of the future.
Yes.
And of course, you know, in a sense, it that sort of says something about the way in which we often blithely engage in prediction, in a sense, kind of oblivious to the potential of being wrong, and sometimes very wrong, sometimes catastrophically wrong, and yet sometimes we are amazingly successful at being able to predict what is going to occur. It's a very interesting reality with which we wrestle.
Yes, it is, Greg. One of the things that we've discovered is that systems tend to divide themselves into roughly two categories. The ones that are simple, and these are the ones in which we can do a very good job of predicting things. I remember, you know, you can look in Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court and see how effective it is to be able to predict eclipses of the sun. And this was also one of my early childhood experiences. I can remember looking at the front page of the New York Times, and it said that there was going to be an eclipse of the sun that day, and it would start at such and such a time, and it would end at such and such a time. And I thought this was amazing that we could do that. And also during the era of space exploration that took place at the end of the 1970s and the 1980s, when we were sending spacecraft out to explore the outer planets, to me it was just amazing. I would see the trajectories of these spacecraft, and they would have to loop around the sun, and then they would loop twice around the Earth, and 7 months later, they would pass by the moons of Jupiter, and they did this precisely. It's an amazingly complicated engineering task to be able to achieve this. But from a mathematical standpoint, the laws of gravitation were worked out 3 centuries ago by Isaac Newton, and it's not that complicated a mathematical problem. So the simple systems are handled relatively easily. It's the systems with a lot of different variables, such as the weather or car scheduling, that turns out to be the problems that, even though they seem sort of ordinary, they're phenomenally difficult. And mathematics hasn't thrown in the towel, because even if we can't do things exactly, there's always the hope that we can do things well enough to be able to make useful progress in the problem. Even if you can't predict the weather perfectly, if you can say, okay, it's going to rain 80% of the time on Friday, that's still good enough for a lot of practical purposes.
Well, and you talk about how value can be gained from what might turn out to be sort of a wild goose chase of one kind or another. If a scientist has pursued something which ultimately their central goal cannot be achieved, there might be ancillary goals that yield all kinds of benefits. You say at one point the story of such failures and the surprising developments that occur because of them is actually a lot of what you talk about in this book.
Yes, I think that one of the things that's been extremely important in the development of both science and mathematics is that dead ends are not absolute. Sometimes what happens is we run into a dead end, but in trying to circumvent it, we find another even more useful solution. If you take a look at some of the numerous dead ends that we've encountered in science in the 17th century, We were still trying to explore whether or not alchemy was the way to understand the universe and whether or not there would be a philosopher's stone whose touch would transmute base metals into gold. That didn't work out. And certainly it might be nice to find something which would change things into gold, but what we actually did was we actually uncovered the atomic theory, which turns out to explain matter. And once we discovered how to do chemistry, we were able to devise drugs and all sorts of chemicals which make our lives a whole lot better than I can possibly imagine alchemy or the ability to change a base metal into gold would be. I'd much rather live in a world today with all the wonderful technological developments we have than a world in which there was some magic rock somewhere, which, if you managed to find it, it would change lead into gold.
Hmm. At one point in your book, you quote somebody by the name of Hardy, saying that G.H. Hardy, that a mathematician is like a painter or a poet, a maker of patterns. And it's very interesting how here and there in the book we will see the interesting parallels drawn, how mathematics can be actually a world of great beauty. And I think a lot of us who have not probed deeply enough into mathematics or given it the care it deserves have not managed to see it that way. We see it exactly the opposite. But in your book, you also draw a couple of interesting contrasts. For instance, drawing an interesting contrast between what can happen with mathematicians and scientists when they are blocked in trying to achieve something or discover something versus the writer's block of an author or a composer. Just talk for a moment about the interesting difference there. I think it's a fascinating observation.
Thank you very much. It interested me, too, because I know several creative people, and they're writers or they're musicians, and sometimes what happens is that a writer runs into writer's block. He either doesn't have ideas or he doesn't feel that the ideas that he have are worth developing, and I think every writer knows that after you've produced several creative works, sometimes you just sort of hit a dead end. But that's a failure of the creative process as far as you're concerned. It's not a failure of literature or music. There's still books to be written and music to be composed. You just can't do it at the moment. But for scientists, it's very different, because what might happen is you might be investigating a problem, and it may turn out that there is no solution. This has happened in mathematics. This has happened in science. And sometimes it's just an inevitable feature of the world. One of the ways in which it impacts our lives is the fact that the electoral process in the United States is fundamentally flawed and cannot be fixed when you have elections in which you have three or more candidates. This was one of the major discoveries of the 20th century, in that if you have an election with three or more candidates, there's no perfect procedure for determining the winner. You might decide that, okay, what we're going to do is we're just going to take the guy who gets the most votes, even if he doesn't get a majority of the votes, and elect him. But many states, what they do is, if they have a number of candidates and there isn't a clear winner, what they do is they have a runoff between the top two candidates. And what can happen in that instance is that the people who voted for people who were eliminated from the ballot vote for the runner-up, and as a result, the person who was the runner-up in the initial balloting ends up winning the election. This has happened numerous times. And it turns out that no matter how you try to tweak the system of determining a winner in such a situation, you can't fix it. And another thing that you can't fix is you can't fix the Electoral College. There's no way of preventing the fact that voters in some states are going to carry more clout in presidential elections than voters in other states.
Hmm. So, in a sense, it is pointing up the untidiness, and this would be one of those problems that is maybe on the surface it doesn't seem like it, but in fact is so complicated that at least up until now it has eluded tidy solution. You call the discovery of this untidiness one of the big three discoveries of the 20th century, which have really shown scientists and mathematicians and the rest of the world as well, that there are real limits to what we can in fact understand and accomplish.
Yes, I think the other two that we discovered is one that most people have heard about, the uncertainty principle in physics. The uncertainty principle basically says that there's a limit to how well you can determine where the really small things in the universe are and how fast they're moving. It's just something that is a fundamental feature of our universe that you cannot do this perfectly. And that's one of the things that impacts prediction. But it's also one of the things that, getting back to something that you talked about earlier, it's a dead end, but it's a dead end that has changed our world remarkably and for the better, because if it weren't for the discovery of that dead end, we wouldn't have lasers, we wouldn't have computers, we wouldn't have magnetic resonance imagers, we wouldn't have everything that the electronics industry has been able to produce over the past half century. And the other discovery is one that's a little more concerned with mathematics, but it also delves into philosophy. When I took geometry in high school, we proved things, and it seemed like everything in geometry could be proved if you just took enough time with it. But it turns out that one of the discoveries of mathematics is that not all mathematical truths can be proved. There are some things which, even though they're true, we may never develop the tools necessary to prove them. And that's impacted philosophy as well, because people think, okay, there are fundamental features to knowledge that may forever elude us.
I think at one point you are issuing, an important warning in pointing out that we sometimes find ourselves sort of very taken by a certain discovery which has lots of sizzle, when in fact, in terms of application to our daily lives, there isn't a whole lot of direct application. And you suggest, for instance, the theory of relativity as something that is undeniably important, but not necessarily to every Tom, Dick, and Harry and their daily lives, compared to other breakthroughs, which in fact have much more impact on our daily lives. I thought that was an intriguing observation as well.
Thank you very much. I thought it's important because we often overrate things, and I don't think that the theory of relativity can be overrated either as an intellectual achievement, because Time magazine had Albert Einstein being the man of the century, and certainly from numerous standpoints, from the fact that it's a brilliant, brilliant theory, and from the fact that Einstein basically put physics on the map so that people thought this is something that is interesting, they discover interesting features about the universe. But from a day-in, day-out basis, all that has really come from the theory of relativity is we did develop the atomic bomb, which certainly has had a profound impact on our life. And it also enabled atomic power, which is widely used in some countries, not so widely used in the United States, as you know. But if you look at a much more what might be called prosaic development in mathematics and physics, the development of the theory of electromagnetism, there was a very simple experiment performed by Michael Faraday in the 1820s or 1830s called the principle of electromagnetic induction. And he discovered a relationship between electricity and magnetism that basically enabled us to build generators, the generators that power our lives, the generator that connects, that supplies the electricity to enable us to conduct this conversation. It's far more useful, and most people have not heard of either Faraday or Maxwell. And these people had a much more profound effect upon our daily lives. Electricity is far more important than relativity.
I think towards that end, I mean, you're so right that we don't stop to think, first of all, about the importance of something like electricity, and we don't stop to think about what makes electricity possible, and especially what the sort of breakthroughs that allow us to use electricity, to manipulate it, to develop it, to find more sources of it, and so on. We just don't We just don't think about that. Another similar moment in your book, I think, is when you talk, I think it's right off the bat in chapter one, you talk about the importance of measurement. And of course, this takes us back many centuries before we were discovering electricity. But just the idea of measurement being a profound human accomplishment. You say measurement is one of man's greatest achievements. While language and tools may be the inventions that initially enabled civilization to exist, without measurement, it could not have progressed very hard. Measurement and counting, the obvious predecessors to measurement, were man's initial forays into mathematics and science. I mean, I really love the way you take us back to, in a sense, the very beginning of all of this. And I wonder if you could explain how, beyond it just being interesting, how that might also be helpful to us or beneficial to us to think about this.
Well, I always emphasize in some of my classes how important precise measurement is. And one of the things that mathematics does is mathematics enables us to quantify what measurement is. I think, for instance, every person nowadays has a computer in their house. And if you think of the hard drive as spinning around at 7,200 revolutions per minute, and there are gigabytes of data in there, and you're trying to read those gigabytes of data, you have to know precisely what is passing under the read head at any particular instant in order to make sure that you're getting precisely the information that you need. So if you don't do this with perfect precision, when you click up a Word document, what might happen is you might get all sorts of different information. And the only way that we can do this is to be able to measure things and machine them to incredible levels of accuracy. And if you look at the history of civilization, the history of civilization is a history of improving the precision of measurement, improving the ability to be able to calculate with regard to measurement, and improving the engineering that enables us to produce objects which are machined or fabricated to ever and ever higher levels of precision.
I have to say in closing that I will probably never sit at the counter of a diner in quite the same way after reading an interesting observation which you make early in the book. Tell our listeners, when you sit at the counter of a diner, what you find yourself watching and being fascinated by and appreciating, something which most of the rest of us fail to appreciate or understand.
Well, part of the book is about the integration of tasks smoothly. And one of the first times that I really noticed this was when I was in graduate school. And when you're in graduate school, normally you find yourself scrounging up cereal for breakfast every day. But every so often I could afford to go to a diner. And there was a short order cook there, and the way the guy moved was just absolute poetry. There's a big rectangular grill, and the guy had the fried eggs, all the eggs in one area, the hash browns in another, the waffles and pancakes in a third place, and the bacon and sausage in another. And it seemed like he was always attending to something, but whenever the eggs were ready, the eggs never got burned. He just moved over smoothly, flipped them over, took them off the grill when necessary. The pancakes and not the waffles, because those are done on a waffle iron generally, but the pancakes, he always flipped them over precisely right. He was moving from place to place, and I can still remember. It was just a joy to watch, and a lot of people, you know, we all take pleasure in watching certain tasks being performed. You can, you know, but to me, when people gather around an excavation site, basically nothing is happening, or at least you very rarely see anything happening. But during the rush hour at breakfast, just watch the short order cook. Poetry in motion.
Absolutely. The book, again, is called How Math Explains the World, A Guide to the Power of Numbers from Car Repair to Modern Physics, with thorough and interesting discussions about all kinds of things, including the universe itself and its sort of disorganization, the the problem with democracy and trying to create exactly the right scenario by which all are equally represented, the way in which logic operates, and so much real-life application. The book is a Smithsonian book published by HarperCollins. And Professor James D. Stein, I have thoroughly enjoyed this. I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. I've enjoyed it, too.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two. I hold in my hands a beautiful book from National Geographic, and in some ways I'm sort of holding the whole universe in my hands, which is quite an interesting experience. The reason is that this book has quite an ambitious scope to it. It's called Sizing Up the Universe, The Cosmos in Perspective. And the author of the book, co-author, Richard Gott III, professor of astrophysics at Princeton University, has tried to help us understand the scope of the universe, just how large it is, how large important bodies in the universe are, how far they are apart from each other, and trying to help us grasp all this beyond the mere numbers, which after a while utterly overwhelm us. And so it is a lesson in trying to give us perspective on the immensity of the universe. And along the way, we are also treated to absolutely gorgeous photographs of jaw-dropping beauty. And so I'm so excited for this opportunity to speak with Professor Gott about this book, again called Sizing Up the Universe, The Cosmos in Perspective, which comes to us from National Geographic. Professor Gott, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Looking forward to talking to you very much. I have to say right off the bat, one of the things I especially enjoyed was something you say, I believe, in the book's introduction about how, in many cases, children are drawn to astronomy the same way they're often drawn to dinosaurs because of the fact that kids love big things, and not much is bigger than the universe itself. I guess nothing is.
That's right. When I got interested in astronomy when I was 8 years old, and I was interested in the planets. Things in astronomy are even bigger than dinosaurs, so I got interested in astronomy.
And I guess what I really appreciate, too, is that when you first study astronomy, you're studying things like the order of the planets and the satellites revolving around them and eventually things like our galaxy and so on. But boy, when you seriously study astronomy, you get away from some of that tangibility pretty quickly. And it becomes, in some ways, what at least feels like a much different science, a much different discipline than the more basic astronomy where we all begin. And I love the fact that your book really, in so many ways, is content with astronomy, in a sense, at its most basic, at its most accessible level, for as complex and mind-blowing as a lot of this is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yes. We start out by showing, you know, how big things look in the sky, how the ancient Greeks figured out, you know, how big the moon was, how big the sun was, how far away things are. And this has been steady progress over the centuries. Hubble discovered that there were other galaxies, that they were very far away. To give you an idea, if we shrink the Earth in size by a factor of a billion, we're all familiar with a billion, you know, a dollar will get you a hamburger, $1 billion makes you a billionaire. If you shrink by a factor of a billion the Earth, it will be as large as a marble. So if you have the Earth as large as a marble, the sun is a giant beach ball, 55 inches across, over 500, about 500 feet away. That's more than the length of a football field. And the nearest star on that scale is Proxima Centauri, which is about the size of a basketball, and it would be 25,000 miles away. And, you know, you drive that far in your car over the years. So it's an enormous distance just to the nearest star. And that's to say nothing of, you know, the fact that we have a whole galaxy we live in a galaxy with 100 billion stars in them. So the distances out there are truly enormous.
Help us understand how we measure distance when we are talking about those kind of distances. I guess I don't mean what kind of numbers do we use, but more how do we accurately determine distances that are so vast?
Well, one by parallax, by its 3D vision, really, we'll observe a star from one side of the Earth's orbit. 6 months later, the Earth moves to the other side of its orbit. We've learned from previous studies how big the Earth's orbit is. And so when you move 6 months away, the Earth moves to the other side of the sun, and you see that star from a different point of view. So against background stars, it shifts slightly. It's just like the 3D vision that you used in Avatar to see the things in the foreground or in the background. So we can see that the nearby stars figure out how far away they are, and we found that that they're on the scale that I talked about. If the sun's about 500 feet away, the nearest star would be about 25,000 miles away. That's how we discovered that.
As you discuss some of the more familiar heavenly bodies in the sky, you made a point that I had never really stopped to think about, which is the fact that when we look up in the sky, the sun and the moon appear to be almost exactly the same size. I mean, to our unaided eye, and of course they are vastly dissimilar in their actual size, but almost identical in size and how they appear to us. It just made me realize how confusing that had to be for early man. And it probably led to centuries of a great misunderstanding about the nature of the sun and the moon. That's, I suppose, just sheer coincidence that they appear to be nearly identical in the sky.
That's fairly pretty much sheer coincidence. The size of the sun in apparent size, it's about half a degree, is pretty much determined by the fact that the Earth should have a reasonable temperature, that water shouldn't boil or freeze in the oceans. And if the sun were like twice as big in apparent size in the sky, the oceans would boil because it'd be like having four suns up in the sky if the sun were twice as big. So if the sun were twice as far away, and only a quarter of a degree across in the sky, then the oceans would all freeze, and we'd be so for the Earth to be habitable, the sun has to be pretty much the size it is. The moon, being the size it is, produces tides that are kind of reasonable, and that can help your amphibians get onto the land, maybe. So the moon, being the size it is actually a little bit helpful to life as well. But as you say, this was confusing to people. Aristarchus was the first one that really figured out that the sun must be much further away than the moon. The first quarter moon and the last quarter moon, these are the phases of the moon. New moon, first quarter, full moon, last quarter, new moon again. These are separated by 1 week each. And so they're equally spaced around the moon's orbit. And the first quarter moon is when it's half illuminated by the sun. And so he could figure out that if this was the way the moon was being illuminated in its orbit, the sun had to be much further away than the size of the moon's orbit. If the sun were only twice as far away as the moon, then that space between first and last quarter would only take up a third of the month instead of a half a month. So by geometric reasoning, he figured out that the sun was much further away than the moon, and therefore much bigger than the moon. And he could see that the Earth was about three times the size of the moon, because he could see the Earth's shadow on the moon during a total lunar eclipse of the moon. And so he was able to deduce that the sun was bigger than the Earth, and therefore he thought that the Earth should go around the sun rather than the other way around. And so people didn't believe him, And because they didn't believe him, it took till Copernicus, about 1,700 years later, until we were finally convinced. So people could have figured this out in the ancient Greek days if they were just tiny bit smarter.
Or a little more open to what... Right, or been a little more open to what on the surface had to seem like a preposterous idea. I want to ask I want to ask you about something that I think is really important for all that we find in this book, and that is taken up early on in what you title "The Shape of the Sky." This is a point in the book in which you are really trying to help us sort of unleash ourselves from a view of how our galaxy and our universe are shaped that is too constrained in order to really take in its full magnificence. Help us understand what we need to do to really grasp the shape of the sky, as you put it.
Well, when you go out at night in dark sight, you can see the sky overhead. It looks like a dome overhead, and the Earth looks flat, and it goes out to the horizon like a plate. And there's a dome overhead. That's a hemisphere. That's half of a sphere. But you can't see the rest of the sky because the Earth blocks your view. So if you imagine putting on a spacesuit and then imagine the Earth would disappear suddenly, you could see the rest of the sky, which is another hemisphere below you. You could see the sun. It's below the surface of the Earth, but just your view of it was blocked before. The sun is still there. It's just down below you. So if the Earth were to disappear, you would be surrounded by a complete sphere of stars. We call this the celestial sphere. And you could see the Milky Way going around in a circle around the sky. We live on a galaxy that looks like a dinner plate. We live in the plate. So if you look out in large distances, you're looking out in the plane of the plate. You see this band of stars, a faint band of stars going around the whole sky called the Milky Way. And the rest of the stars that you see scattered all over the sky, these are actually very close to us in the dinner plate. And these are the close stars, the bright stars. They're just as bright as the sun, in many cases brighter than the sun, but they're so far away that they look like tiny points of light. And this was realized only after Copernicus, but the ancient Greeks could have thought of that as well if they'd just been a little bit cleverer.
I'm reminded of a moment in one of the Star Trek motion pictures, the second one, The Wrath of Khan, where the Enterprise is confronted by another Federation ship that's been taken over by the villain of the movie, Khan, and they are both in a nebula where their sensors don't work, but what allows the Enterprise to outsmart Khan and the other ship is that they think spatially in every direction versus on a flat plane. And Khan, as he's flying this other ship around, is only thinking, in a sense, on that flat dinner plate, not up and down. Which is the way, when you watch the classic Star Trek TV series from the 60s, that's the only way we ever saw the Enterprise move, was along this flat plane as though there were a highway through space. And it's, in a sense, as we leap forward a couple of decades, the producers of Star Trek have made that same leap of understanding the galaxy as and the whole universe, for that matter, as this immense sphere rather than that flat dinner plate, which is usually how most of us envision all this.
Right. It's very important to think of the universe in three dimensions. I've studied galaxy clustering, and we found that there's a sponge-like connection of galaxies. The great clusters of galaxies are connected by filaments. It makes a sponge-like structure. And you really have to think in three dimensions to see that. And we find out there are great walls of galaxies connecting clusters of galaxies. Mario Jurich and I discovered this, measured this Sloan Great Wall of galaxies, 1.37 billion light years across. And this is the largest structure in the universe. It got me in the Guinness Book of World Records, to my surprise. And it's a great record, too, because of all the records in the Guinness Book, there's the largest pickup truck, the largest pumpkin, you know, of all the largest things in the Guinness Book, we're the largest of the largest. So there's enormous structures out there, a chain of galaxies. These are all brought together by the action of gravity over the course of 13 billion years. And so thinking three-dimensionally rather than in a plane was very important for us to understand this cosmic web.
Hmm. And you mentioned again back in that chapter called The Shape of the Sky, there are really only six human beings in history that have had the chance to actually take in the sky all at once, and that would be six Apollo astronauts.
Yes, these are Apollo astronauts that actually ventured outside their capsule to retrieve some experiments that were stored on the outside. They got a chance to look around the whole sky. The astronauts that are in the space shuttle, almost half their view is still blocked off by the Earth. They're in low Earth orbit, only a couple of hundred miles up. So they basically can only see half the sky just like we can on Earth. And the Apollo astronauts who were inside their capsules, they just got to look out a little bitty window. But if you actually went out of your capsule, you could see the whole sky, and you would see the Earth over there and the moon over there and the sun over there and then all the stars surrounding you. So it's a view that only a few people have had.
Right. And in a sense, your book is an effort to give all of us that view, or at least help us grasp the notion of what that view might be like. I want you to have the opportunity to talk a moment about some of the beautiful photographs that are in your book that were taken in a surprisingly simple fashion in somebody's backyard. Tell us about where some of these wonderful, especially colorful photographs come from and how accessible these kind of photographs are to anybody who just happens to have the right equipment in their backyard.
Well, a number of the photographs in our book were taken by my co-author, Bob Vanderbilt, who's another professor at Princeton, but he's an amateur astronomer. And when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, starting to be interested in astronomy was really a backyard hobby. You could go out and see the moon, the planets. You could see the M31 galaxy, Andromeda galaxy. You could see nebulas. But what's happened over the years is light pollution has brightened the sky so that the faint objects like the galaxies and the nebula disappeared from view. But luckily, we've discovered astrophotography. We have CCD cameras now that are very sensitive, very much more sensitive than film. And we have filters so that you can filter out most of the light from the sky pollution and just look at one wavelength that the nebula might be emitting, a hydrogen alpha light that's coming from a nebula. So Bob has been able to take pictures from his backyard that are astonishing, that rival the ones taken in the largest observatories. We have a picture in the book of the Eagle Nebula that Bob took from his backyard, and we put it side by side with the best picture of this from the Hubble Space Telescope. And you can see the Hubble Space Telescope picture's a bit sharper. Bob's has better colors because he's plotting it at the correct colors. The nebula really looks red, and the Hubble picture looks green because they're using a false color system to illustrate various scientific points. So it's amazing that someone from their backyard in New Jersey with a 10-inch diameter telescope can take a picture that would rival the Hubble Space Telescope. And if you want to take a picture of a planet, we now have the digital cameras allow us to take videos where we can take hundreds of pictures of this in a sequence, and then there's software programs that will pick out those moments of great scene where there's a moment of great clarity in the atmosphere, and you can see the surface features better. It'll throw the bad pictures away automatically and add up the good pictures to give you really wonderful pictures of the planets. So we have in there a picture of Jupiter where you can see Jupiter's red spot. You can see the cloud layers in Jupiter. Bob has taken wonderful pictures of the planets and the moon. So we're hoping that this book, by showing off some of the beautiful pictures that you can take from your backyard, will encourage kids who love to take pictures with their digital cameras and put them on their computer, might be interested in taking up this as a hobby, because it's really become a backyard hobby once again.
It's very, very good. Spreads also that compare for us, for instance, the difference between Katrina and Jupiter's Great Red Spot, and the difference between the Grand Canyon and some of the features on Mars, and the difference between the United States and one single sunspot, helps us understand how small we are and how immense this universe is. The book, again, is called Sizing Up the Universe. And Dr. Richard Gott, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk.